Hello and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and this is High Performance Teams. Please enjoy and remember to subscribe. Kath Bishop, a multiple world champion and Olympic silver medalist in rowing, and her new book, The Long Win, The Search for a Better Way to Succeed. We had a great conversation about the high performance aspects of the sport of rowing, some kind of detail I'd never even thought of before, and it was fascinating. But we also spoke about the mental aspects of sport and sports in general and why this pursuit of winning has failed us. And her three main themes of the book being the clarity of what matters, constant learning, and connection and collaboration as opposed to competition. Wonderful insights, great conversation with an interesting person. Please enjoy Kath Bishop. This episode is proudly brought to you by Salesforce. Do you know that right now you can sign up for a free 10-week online training course provided by Salesforce? You heard right. Salesforce is providing you a free 10-week training program, teaching you the fundamentals of Salesforce. Salesforce qualifications are in big demand right now in South Africa and all over the world. At the end of this course, you will be eligible for many jobs in the Salesforce ecosystem. So click on the link in the show notes. Sign up today and reskill yourself for the future. I'm very excited to have you on the show today, and we're going to get into the weeds and all things. But let's just go to where it all began between you and I. And this conversation started because of a post that someone had put out there and you had reshared or put a comment on regarding the invasive nature of the press with the French Open tennis. So I don't know if you want to dig in there, but I thought, anyway, let's just begin where it all began for us and say, well, what is the press? You've been a professional athlete. What does the press mean to you then? And what does it mean to you today?
I think the post that we connected on was one of those moments of kind of suddenly seeing things in a different perspective when Naomi Osaka actually stood up and said, you know, these press conferences, they're not helping my performance, they're not helping me, they're causing anxiety. And it then split the world into sort of half of the people hanging on to the way it's always been, saying, oh, that's part of the job, that's just what you have to do, you have to toughen up, this sort of old traditional macho narrative. And actually, you know, another half of the world, myself being in this half, going, isn't that interesting? If this isn't actually helping a tennis star to perform, an athlete to perform, then why are we doing this? Why would we deliberately set something up that actually detracts from the very thing that they're brilliant at? And who is it actually serving? And why do we do them like this? Why can't we be more flexible? Why couldn't we do them in some different ways? And so it typified actually a lot of what I do at the moment, which is to challenge some of the ways in which we approach sport, the frames, the constraints we put around sport, and saying, actually, what's the purpose of this? And maybe we should do things a little bit differently.
Yeah, so it was a kickoff point for a couple of reasons. And for me, I actually wasn't aware of what was going on and I hadn't heard of it. But just the way I could read in the words that you chose in your, because you didn't just do a reshare, it was a, you know, you put a lot of effort into your post there. And I thought, wow, I can read that. So who is this person writing this comment? And then to see that you have a silver medal in the Olympics and you're a world champion in two different disciplines and a career in hostility in the, you know, the Foreign Office in war zones like Sarajevo and Iraq, you know, there was something inspirational there. And then I saw, but you've got a book out about this kind of thing too. And I thought, well, let me just try my luck and see if Kath will connect. And thank you so much for connecting. And here we are talking about it. So I listened to your book and it was fantastic. I love the title.
The long win.
The long win.
The search for a better way to succeed.
Yeah. It's something that I've been sharing in my life, in my family and friends' lives. Like, you know, there's a lot of turbulence in everyone's lives right now. And, you know, oftentimes you get to this bump and you think, well, do I put the effort in to flatten this bump or do I play the big game and say, well, this is just part of the journey? So how long did it take you to just sort of get to this the title of The Long Win? I'm curious about the title and then and what it means to you.
Yeah, so I've been a long time, I think, thinking about actually, the whole topic of The Long Win has been on my mind for a couple of decades, and the writing of it took probably a good 4 years, really thinking about how this issue of winning plays out across all these different parts of our lives. And so initially I was actually focusing on, you know, where it's not working and constantly finding places where winners, you know, it's not working for the winners. They're depressed, they're unfulfilled, they're disengaged, they're burnt out, whether we're looking at education or business or sport. And then actually over time I was thinking, well, but how do we do this differently? Because lots of people say we've got no other option. Either you go soft and you don't perform, or you do it like this. And I think that just doesn't make sense. And we know that this isn't helping us to perform. So why can't we find a different way? There are ideas out there. There is good practice out there. And so that was the beginning of long win thinking, if you like. And for a while I thought, do I actually reject the whole winning concept? But actually it's more reframing it. I'm not anti-winning. And sometimes people automatically feel if you don't like the way it's done, then you must be somebody who just wants everyone to participate and get a medal. And that's in this binary world. That's what people think I must be advocating, but I'm not. I'm advocating a different way of trying to excel that has a broader framework around it. And so I thought I want to reframe the win. And a big part of it is thinking about not just the next short-term win, not just winning the next race or hitting your next quarterly targets or, you know, but actually thinking over the longer term, what's the stuff that matters? And if we think about winning over the longer term, going for the long win, it can sometimes look really different from those short-term wins.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you made that distinction as well with this idea that I'm not anti-winning, because that was one of my immediate thoughts when I saw your profile and you had the long win. And I thought, you know, the type of message that just resonates with me was that it's an alternative to not go for the win. But as soon as I got into the book, within the first, well, I did the audiobook and the first couple of minutes of listening, I realized it's not that. This is not that. This is something different, and it's very interesting. But you bring in a lot of things which got me a bit down a rabbit hole too. You know, watching The Weight of Gold, you know, Michael Phelps documentary too, I've enjoyed this little journey. But we've gone quite deep quite quickly, and I actually want to backpedal a little bit if you're okay with that, because let's talk a bit about the sport and you as a professional. I mean, I'm talking to a world champion and an Olympic medalist, and that's not every day that you get that. So from a complete layman, I do various different sports. Paddling a canoe or a kayak is one of them. But I mean, rowing, that's something different. It is a high performance team. I'm all about high performance teams. So tell me about your, like, 2 versus 8, rowing on your own, paddling. How does this journey begin and what are the disciplines?
Oh, yeah. So there's a lot in that. I mean, actually, I had a really wonderful beginning to my rowing journey in that it was totally unexpected and it came quite late. So I actually wasn't somebody who excelled at sport at school. I think I was tall, a little bit uncoordinated, probably in my teenage years. And the sporty people were the ones who did all the sports really well and were sort of small and nippy and fast at running. So I was really kind of labelled there, and I felt quite sad about that, but I just sort of couldn't find a way to access sport, and I felt very much labelled that it's just not your thing. You can do other things, doesn't matter. So when I went to university, I didn't intend to take up any particular new sport. I was sort of not sure what I would take up, maybe a bit of political debating, maybe a bit of drama, who knows? And then when they came and said, oh, do you want to, you know, when you go and look at all the different clubs, and there was this rowing club and they said, do you want to sign up? You're tall, you'd be good at this. And actually I thought, oh no, that looks really full on and I'm not sporty. So that's not going to work for me. And they have to get up really early in the morning. That doesn't sound like student life to me. So I actually initially didn't sign up. But I didn't sign up for anything really, because I was sort of quite at a crossroads of, I'm not really sure what I want to spend my spare time doing. But over the next sort of few weeks, lots of people who were becoming my friends were doing this crazy rowing thing, starting it from novice, having all sorts of fun, great camaraderie. And I felt a little envious. I still thought it's not going to be for me. How could it be? I'm just not sporty. But about a month into that first term, they actually came and some friends, you know, they came and knocked on the door and they said, you know, we need your help. You know, we know at first you're probably going to say no, but just hear us out. And somebody had got injured in their crew of 8. So 8 rowers and a cox. That's how they learn. That's how the boat we learnt in at university. So it's a big boat. It's quite safe. It doesn't turn over. And they said, you know, someone's got injured. We need somebody basically for 3 weeks so we can do these novice races at the end of term. Will you do it?
So they just wanted to do a bum in a seat kind of thing. Just plug in, yeah, you're
absolutely
tall enough.
Absolutely.
Okay.
An 8th bum on the seat. That was really all I was there for. They can't do it with 7 people. They can't go out. And they'd ask some others first. And so initially I was like, oh no, I won't be any good, all of this sort of thing. But, you know, they wore me down and I actually was secretly quite curious about, I'd love to have a go. So I said, I'm just going to come out tomorrow morning and it'd probably be a disaster, but I'll just give it a go tomorrow morning. So we got up really super early the next morning and we cycled off to the river and it was all misty and quite magical. And it was chaotic because it was students learning. And so all the boats are sort of zigzagged down this river because they can't steer very well. And they're all kind of causing a traffic jam. But there was so much sort of just joy and, you know, teamwork in the air. And I got in and I was obviously hopeless because who isn't when they start a new sport? And, you know, the lovely thing was I just had to get on with it. And for me, that's where rowing is a team sport that got me hooked at a different level. When I was playing a team sport at school and I was playing hockey or something, I felt incompetent. I generally was incompetent. And so I would avoid the ball. I'd sort of stand on the pitch. I'd run away from being involved in it. When I got in a rowing boat, I couldn't run away. I couldn't get out. I mean, it's really hard to get out and the river is cold and wet and not very attractive in the morning. And so I then had the choice of, do you know what? You've got to opt in and you've got to opt into trying to do the best you can do at the same time as the people around you. So you're constantly aware of your own effort and the collective effort. If you're not in time with others, your effort is wasted. And that lovely balance of being in a team where you're constantly balancing individual effort, collective effort, and you're just opting in, you're just doing the best you can. And if you mess a stroke up, you just try and make the next one better because you've got to keep going because the person behind you is going to come up and, you know, will kind of hit you in the back with their oar if you stop. And that was such a lovely introduction to a real team experience.
Well, that's great. I kept wanting to interrupt you, but you got so many points there that I want to talk about. So was there, so you said, you wanted to chase away from the ball. You don't give me the ball in hockey. And you felt like you wanted to get out of this. So in the moment, like going down the river, 3 minutes in, you actually felt like, I actually want to get out, but you can't. And you kind of like, this train is moving and can't get off now. So was there times that you wanted to get off and you couldn't?
Yeah, right at the beginning, I actually made a kind of real mistake because I was so new in the boat and they'd put me at the back of the boat and we were drifting to the bank. I actually broke my oar because I was holding onto it so rigidly and I was the first one to get towards the bank and they were old beginner's oars as well. And so I just didn't know, I didn't have the sort of intelligence to sort of just, you have to kind of pull it in slightly. And so I just kind of stuck it against the bank as we went into it and broke it. So I actually broke an oar within 5 minutes of being in the boat. And again, I thought, oh my God, this is it. I knew I'd be awful. I told you I'd be rubbish. And everyone just turned around and laughed. And the coach on the bank just said, you know, because we were literally only a couple of meters from where we'd started at this point. He just said, give me your oar, you know, what was left of it. And I'm going to go and get another one. I couldn't get out still
couldn't get out. But isn't it also fascinating, you're talking there really about limiting beliefs and negative self-talk. You know, maybe you talked yourself into that and there we can say, you see, I told you. And, you know, you're talking to yourself in this moment, but still, luckily the team had enough momentum and desire for you to beat, even if it is just the bum in the seat. You need to carry on. We got another 10 minutes or another day or another 3 weeks of this. And maybe it's lucky for you that was the situation because you were dragged on for enough days to enjoy it.
Totally. And actually, by the end of that outing, I just had an amazing time. Just being able to manage. And, you know, there was so much kind of joy and positivity. And we were just supporting each other. Everyone was a bit hopeless. I mean, they'd done it, okay, a few weeks more. So obviously, they're a little bit better. But they're still making loads of mistakes around me as well. And so it was just a sort of good fun. Okay, well, let's see if we can do better the next stroke. Oh, okay, let's just try the next stroke. And I felt immediately part of something. And they were so grateful that I had enabled them to go out that day. And that actually, if I kept going, they'd be able to carry on to do this sort of initial race. So there was just lots of positivity from being belonging and being part of something.
Yeah, the team sports. I mean, it is great to be part of a team. I concur. It's a lovely feeling knowing that you're adding to something there, and particularly when you're the person that, I mean, you effectively unlocked that team because without you, the team wouldn't have got on the water. So that's great. Now, so that sounded to me like that was an 8-person boat. I don't know if I'm using the right terms here. So, what's the next step when you continue on this journey and you start building up a level and county and, you know, representing England, etc. You know, fast forward the journey to. Is it on that 8-person discipline or do you start branching out or where does the journey go?
So I largely at university stayed in an eight, and I went on to row at kind of a college level and then a university level. So I stepped up through the university, and actually there were people at the coaches then at the university level had contacts at the British team level. And so they knew I had some potential when I got to the end of, about to leave university. So, you know, I was stepping up levels, still largely in an eight, and actually right at the end, then I spent some time in a pair. So two of us. Because there were two of us who had potential and were interested in carrying on after university. And that's then a different discipline, because you then obviously there's no cox this time. You're steering yourselves and you're very much dependent on each other. So you have one or each. So I often describe it as being like having a tightrope walker's pole that's cut in half, because you are dependent on each other for balance and you're sitting one in front of each other. And so to balance the strokes, to balance the boat in between the efforts, to allow it to run on as a result and optimize the effort you've put in, you have to have this balance and be absolutely in sync. And you can't have an argument, because you can't go anywhere without the other person. You go round in circles. So there's a lovely, you know, that became my favorite boat, because it was the sort of ultimate partnership. You're 50% of it, so you're a huge amount of it. But you have this wonderful need to work in kind of really close synchronicity with your partner, and to work out how to always respond and think the same and support each other.
It's almost, the way you're describing it, I'm picturing there's a bit of ballet in this too, where you have to rely on each other heavily. But where it's even more impressive is that with a sort of, or almost to the split second regular beat, you have to maintain the same rhythm, because you'll steer off. I didn't actually realize, if you don't watch it that closely, that, you know, one of you could pull more than the other. And if you don't continually hit the same stride repeatedly for, I don't know how many minutes it has to carry on like that, it's just about impossible. Well, it is impossible to do well at that unless you're in perfect sync.
Absolutely. And imagine when you get tired. And if you get tired in a sort of slightly different part of the stroke, you start to not go straight. So you have a rudder that's attached to a foot. So you can steer a bit, because obviously you might have the wind that's blowing you. You need to be able to respond, and you need to counter sometimes when you're not perfectly together. But of course, every time you use the rudder, that acts as a brake. But you have a rudder that's attached to your foot. So at the same time as rowing, you're steering yourselves. And, you know, it's definitely a kind of real focus on rhythm is a huge part of rowing, and balance is a huge part of rowing. So you have really big, powerful people. And there are two ways in which a boat moves fast. One is the actual power through the water. But the other part is how far the boat moves in between the strokes. So it's no good just being the most powerful person if you stop the boat because you have poor balance and you're moving out of kilter with the boat moving along the water. You can kill the run of the boat, as we call it, in between the strokes. So you might have somebody who's less powerful, but they're allowing it to run freely in between the strokes. And that's the skill of the support of the sport, that it's this, you've got to be super powerful, and the split second in between each moment of power, you've got to be relaxed in time
and graceful
and perfectly balanced.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of that in aerodynamics too, in the flying. You know, every little input that you give to correct, you're literally putting something into the airflow, and in your case, the water flow. And every millimeter of input is drag, and you're trying to reduce drag by saving 100 grams, running extra, eating less, and now you just put a rudder stroke in, and then there's a break. So it's an incredible, my mind's eye, it shows an incredible synchrony. But like, now you've jumped into the weeds, and I love these kind of discussions about the two-man team. So at that point, had you now left the eights, or how does it transition? Is it a natural progression for the top people go from eight to two? Is it completely different, or where does it separate?
It's a good question. It's not necessarily that there's a top crew, and each country will determine that around the strength of their squad. If you've got two people who are sort of obviously better than the rest at the top, then you probably make that your top boat. So each Olympic squad will choose where its top boat is. Often I think people feel if you know, in a small boat, it's easier to respond as two people within a race. And sometimes, you know, it's easier to get two people to peak, if you like. So it's a different skill, really, to get, you know, eight people peaking on the same day and able to be kind of one mindset. The 8 is the fastest boat that you can have in a rowing team, and there's an excitement to be part of a rowing 8 that's thundering down an Olympic course. But there's also a sort of excitement almost to be in the small boat where you are such a large part, responsible, and able to make decisions that have an immediate big impact on what happens. So we trial in smaller boats. So to prove our worth, if you like, to get selected, you either go into a single scull, so you're on your own with two oars, or you're in pairs and you would swap around and row with sort of everybody else. So they would see your cumulative kind of, you know, how fast other people go with you, how fast you make boats go with other people. And so when we were then trialing, that's why we went into a pair leaving university, so that we could go to national trials and test ourselves and see, you know, how quickly we could kind of start to get up the rankings to get towards the national squad.
Okay, so in one way or another, does everyone either start at 8s and go to less, or do they start at less and go to 8s, which is the natural kind of more logical journey?
Actually, really varies. I think quite often if you start at university, 8s is a thing because it's fun, because it's that team thing. But actually
it's a club and yeah.
Yeah, but often, you know, I also see people who start in singles, juniors, you know, schools. It actually can be either, and there are advantages to either. If you learn in a single, you immediately learn boat moving. Everything that you do is having an impact, so you get that immediate feedback. But actually, the whole joy of the sport is being part of a crew and trying to get that timing with other people. So you actually need both. And even when you're training, even if you're going to be in the Olympic 8, you would spend time in fours and in pairs. You would break down all the time so that you're getting that greater feedback on what you're doing in the boat. And then you put it back together again, and then you break down again. So, you know, we would always go regularly across the boat classes.
Okay, well, it's interesting, and now I just want to spend a few minutes then on the 8s, because as you say, it's the fastest, it's the biggest discipline. But the thing that my background and what I relate to in this is a high performance team, you know, in some ways like no other, because how do you get the most out of it? Again, we spoke about timing. You've got to be completely in sync, and in formation aerobatics like the Red Arrows and the Silver Falcons, you know, you have to be in sync. If the formation is turning to the left, you've got to be turning left, because you could die if you bump each other in the air. Okay, so there's no death in your case, but to get the most out of the team, you have to be perfectly in sync. I mean, just the whole concept of a rowing team and how they have to be on rhythm. I mean, it just sounds fascinating. So, were you more drawn to the twos or more drawn to the eights? Where, despite your performances and how it ended up, which was the bit that captivated you more?
It's actually really difficult. My heart is in both. Because I started in an 8, you know, I loved that, and it's the biggest team experience. But, you know, actually, I loved kind of having to prove myself in a pair. And that was the race that I had, you know, the best races that I had in the Olympics were in a pair. So it's actually really hard to choose, because they're actually just different. And I love both of them. I think you're absolutely right about that similarity that you were setting out there about, you know, if you were flying in formation. Because one of the things in a rowing crew is although people sort of almost imagine it's easy to be in time, but we're not, our seats aren't attached to each other. We're not physically attached to each other at all. We're sitting one in front of the other, so we can watch each other. But of course, you need to anticipate, otherwise you'll be late on the person in front of you. And so there is a huge amount of sensing that goes on. You actually have to sense the water running underneath the hull to get the speed at which you need to travel forward in between each stroke. You actually need to sense the timing of when the boat is just starting to decelerate, that you want to pick up the next stroke. You want to sense the timing of, was I slightly ahead or behind the person in front of me? And I need to adjust by a tiny fraction. We look at video footage and we slow it down into slow motion, so you can't see with your eye how many frames it takes for your oar to enter the water. And then you look at all of the oars, four on each side, you know, and look at, okay, well, actually these oars are taking 3 frames to cover. These oars are taking 4 or 5. So we need to sharpen those up slightly. And these are tiny, tiny fractions that you can't see with the naked eye. But we would sense that. You can sense it. So one of the things I loved about the sport actually is that need to be aware of the feel of the water, the environment you're in, the boat, and the people around you. So you have to be really present. It's not just effort at all. It's effort in that wider context, otherwise the effort is probably wasted and might be slowing you down.
Well, I love this conversation, Kath, because this is exactly the kind of thing that fires me up, and the reason why there is this podcast, the High Performance Teams, because it's well documented for many years now. Incremental gains, you know, the top teams go out there and they go for incremental gains and slowing it down frame by frame. Where were the oars at that point? But that's the one part. How do you fix it? And the fixing part is tricky. You first have to understand that there is a difference. We can see on the frame, okay, you number two, your oar was a bit late. And how much late was it? Well, you know, we can measure it in real time, but how do you translate that into the feeling? That sense feeling is the same in the cockpit. You know, we get back from a display and the five of us are standing around and we're doing the debrief, and one person can say, you know, that as we pulled up for the fourth maneuver, it felt like your call was just a moment later than it usually is. And I was ready to go, but the call came a moment later, so it kind of put me off. And it's that same sense of, okay, we've got video footage, but it's, you know what I'm getting at? The sense of it is there. And in another environment, you know, flying airliners, you're coming in to land, and the joy of it is to fly this airplane, you know, having the beast in your hands and the autopilot's off. And when you're flying it manually, that last little bit, the 1,000 feet or so, when you are completely in sync with your environment, you can feel that you're about to increase the rate of descent, the sink rate, or the sink rate, or the, you know, the rate of descent is arresting slightly. You can feel it and you can react to it before your instruments even start. And as you've done the reaction to correct, then the instrument catches up with you, and then it catches up with you again once the correction. So that's sensing. It's beautiful. You described the water and the speed. It's just lovely.
Yeah, and it's that adjustment that you have to make in the race. And so what we're trying to tune in is that sort of antenna to, or that sixth sense, or that radar that you've got. Because obviously in a race, you're not going to stop and look at video either. So you need to also kind of check that video back with your mental, okay, this is what I'm feeling. And that's actually what it looks like from that third person perspective. Okay, that's interesting. So maybe there's something out of sync there that I need to adjust. But in the race, we are constantly making these adjustments. We are taking maybe, I don't know, 250 strokes over 2,000 meters approximately. You know, roughly, I don't know, 36 to 40 strokes a minute. And we're racing sort of 6 to 7 minutes. So it depends on whether you're in a pair or an eight, perhaps, as to you have a slower race in a pair than you do in an eight. So that's why there's a little bit of kind of variation as to how many strokes it is. But, you know, within all of those, you're trying to make just tiny adjustments all of the time. And every now and then you will have a call that will sort of focus you to bring you back in again. But actually you're trying to use as much of your internal kind of tuning to actually pick those up ahead of anyone calling them, so that you just know you need to do a slight tweak here, a slight tweak there. And the other sort of factor that we're thinking about is the power curve. So where the effort is going on during the stroke. And now we have lots of biomechanical data that comes out of sort of strength gauges that go on to,
okay,
the machine.
You're going to have to, we can't gloss over this, at the power curve. So just explain a bit more. Is that as it relates to, I'm putting in effort as the oar goes in, and then I build it as it's going through the stroke and I release it at the end. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. So what does that look like? Is it smooth going on? How long do you maintain the power, and when does it come off, and what's the drop off like? You know, do you have any little mini peaks in the middle where you slightly let it off and then put a bit more on at the end? And again, can you match those curves up across the boat? Because often you might have a natural tendency to be a bit more powerful at this position and somebody else is more powerful kind of at the end of the stroke. So we're trying to all the time, if we're not putting it on at the same time, we're actually going against each other with our power. So again, you know, during a race, we'll be making sure that we don't just ask more power, we ask for more power in a part of the stroke. So it will be, you know, immediately after it's entered, then we'll do a call to make sure we've sort of sharpened, if you like, the upward bit of that power curve when it comes on. Let's get that as tight as possible together. Then we want to make sure we're maintaining the acceleration without letting it off. And then we want to make sure that we kind of, the oars come quickly out of the water without any drag. So we will, within a race, be thinking about, you know, the different parts. It's not just, I'll just chuck more power on. Because if one person puts it on at the beginning of the stroke and one person puts it on the end of the stroke, you'll probably go slower for more effort.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I'm just thinking now, so you were in the World Champions, Olympics, etc., like 03, 04, 05. When did your career kind of end internationally?
Yeah, so it ended in Athens. So I went to, my first World Championships was 95. I went to the Olympics in Atlanta, Sydney, and then Athens.
Okay, so I mean, that's a long time ago. And are you, when you talk about this...
Thank you. No,
sorry, that didn't come out very well at all. Apologies. You'll understand now why I said that. So in terms of the tech, there was no iPhone in Athens Olympics, and the tech and all the stuff that goes with it, and the sort of the gauges and the data that you can get. So the way you're speaking now about the power curves and stuff, was that all available to you back then?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It was not available. They have better tech that takes less time to fix onto the boat and is available for more sessions, so they would have it on almost all the time now, whereas we had sort of particular periods where it would be on. So they would have more information and it's easier to get, but we did have that information, yes.
Yeah, so that actually comes to my question of really a long time ago. Sorry about that, Kath. What is the, I mean, if that was your view and you must have felt like you were at the forefront of tech at the time, what is your thoughts now on Olympic athletes today and how they are bombarded with the data that you just can't even imagine? I'm sure that you've got a very strong sense, and maybe you're 90% there, of what an athlete might go through with tech available, but you know they might look at you and say, you have no idea. Like, so how does somebody like me even have a concept of it? But they must just be bombarded with so much stuff. How do you make sense of all that? What does an athlete today do?
I think it's a real challenge. I actually think in some ways we were better off having particular periods of it, and then particular periods where we almost had to create our own radar and our own tuning, if you like, and then we would check it again. So I definitely think they are swimming in it, drowning in data. And the dangers are that the coaches spend so much time going through the data and need people to kind of help them filter out the data, that where is that time being pulled away from? And sometimes, you know, the power of data and spreadsheets can pull away from issues of, you know, mental preparation or recovery or the culture. So I think it is a challenge that we can get sort of, you know, obsessed and, you know, just want to pour through all of this data. And at some point you have to stand back and look at the full picture of all the other things that are also important to performance.
Yeah, well, that's incredible. You know, part of this journey for me is to really understand what it takes to be a high performance team. And I really just thought that more data is good. But if you just think about anywhere in your life where you're being bombarded by anything, you know, social media is the obvious one we always talk about. As an athlete, wow, you know, you have that whole social media thing exponential already because you're famous, and then you've got the tech okay. So I know we're actually supposed to be speaking about the mental health aspects, but you've just really got me invigorated on this conversation, and it's been wonderful. I want to zoom into a time, and I want you to share your thoughts and feelings of that first Olympics, because what stood out in your book when I listened to it was, you know, there was something that concerned you, and you were overawed with this idea of being at the Olympics, and this is awesome. But yet, when you want to have a concern, people said, but who are you? This is your first Olympics. You're not worthy even to ask the question. So if you can contrast those feelings, please, of, wow, I'm here, and wow, is this what it really is?
So, yeah, it was a moment of trying to make sense of what's okay to say, what's not okay to say. I think I always felt I'm trying to learn to be a high performance athlete, and that I've got to try and be something different from what I am at that point, because that doesn't feel very comfortable, and why can't I ask about this? And there was a real kind of macho narrative that if you're at the Olympics, you're a serious athlete, you're committed, you're tough, you don't have any weaknesses, you don't ask questions, you just get on with it, you deliver when it matters. And that leaves you very little wiggle room to be yourself and to be your best self if you don't literally fit into that. I don't actually think many people fit into that, really. I think everybody's trying to fit into something because they think it's what they've been told to fit into, or, you know, what the last generation told them to fit into, or what the coach says they've got to fit into. And I think there is a huge switch now to actually listening to an athlete and sort of starting with who they are and what they want and how they can be at their best, that probably an athlete has quite a lot of input on how they can be at their best. Whereas this was a period when it was very much, this is the blueprint. How close can you get to a blueprint that's based on somebody else? And actually, in a fairly male-dominated world, it's really based on men. And so I think, you know, it was challenging, but I, at that point, didn't challenge it. My challenge felt, well, it must be something wrong with me if I want to challenge this, or if I don't really understand it, or if I don't think it's helping me to perform, that's my problem. That's probably because I'm not good enough. Mm. And so I found it very difficult to find the space and the people to have that discussion with. And it was only really then some years later when sports psychologists were more available and more open and ready to talk about the performance mindset that isn't just about saying you're going to win or say you're tough enough. It's actually now looking at what are all the requirements for you to be at your best, and the process piece being really important, not just the outcomes. That was when things shifted and I suddenly found a conversation that was going to help me to work out how to get better.
Okay, yeah, and the message that I remember from the book is that, okay, so maybe the next time around, if I'm either a veteran or I've won some medal or I've become a bit more illustrious in the sport, then they can listen. And then again, you went that journey and still they wouldn't listen. I mean, so, you know, in one point you're telling yourself, it's okay, I'll fix this. And then when you get there with your plan to have fixed it, that plan didn't work either. So, I mean, what goes through your mind at that point? I mean, how do you think up a new narrative now? Or what was the new narrative that you thought of next?
So I think, again, the imposter syndrome sort of looms large in these moments of thinking, well, I'm kind of hearing that I'm still not fitting, even though I went away and tried to do what they wanted me to do. you know, there's still a problem with me. And I think that's, you know, again, this sort of slightly old fashioned cookie cutter approach to things. You know, it was when things shifted and people started to talk about culture. You know, I'm talking the 2000s, if you like, between 2000 and 2004 and increasingly since then, when we started to hear more about not just fixing athletes, but creating an environment within which the athlete can thrive. Now, we're still on that journey because there's still many places where the focus is on fixing individual athletes who aren't right. But, you know, as soon as I started to hear about that, then I started to kind of read much more and really seek that out, and found some sports psychs and some coaches and some people in other sports who were starting to question things similarly.
Yeah, that's it's fascinating. I was about to pose a question along the lines of imposter syndrome when you used the same word, so I'll go for it. So I interviewed a world famous comedian, a South African guy, John Vlismus, and he's celebrated. He's got international awards. He's the top comedian in South Africa. He's got Canadian awards, etc. He had a 20-year career, and on that last day where he was calling it a day, he's going to go on a new journey now. That last day behind the curtain, he had imposter syndrome, wondering, am I about to go on stage? I don't know. Why did they come and see me? What am I going to say that's going to resonate? Can I do this? And as he took on to the stage and the mic, it all came and it worked. But if someone with a 20-year career, someone with two Olympics behind them, can feel that imposter syndrome, well, then it's real. And everybody feels it always. And I suppose the challenge then, the journey for the individual, is to say, well, recognize it as imposter syndrome, but what do you do about it? What is the thing? Is it a shut down the negative self-talk, or practically, what do you do? You're feeling it? What do you do?
So I think you've got a sort of short-term survival option, and then you've got a longer-term thriving option. The
long
latter
win.
Requires, exactly. The latter requires other people, though. So the short-term survival is to focus on what's within your control, to, you know, really come back to the things that, you know you can deliver, and to just look after the things you can look after, if you like. You just can't affect other things. But actually, that's still likely to not be enough for you to really thrive, particularly if you're going to be under massive
pressure.
That's
a band-aid, yeah.
And yeah, exactly. It's a coping mechanism. It's not a flourishing place. We need to then think about, we need others to help us to create a different culture. We need to be able to be ourselves. We need to be able to be vulnerable. We need to feel safety. We need to be able to challenge and be challenged, support and be supported, we need that environment, and with so we're not just we're thinking about the soil in which we're growing. We're not just trying to kind of make the plant grow by looking at it more or kind of watering it. We're actually thinking about what's the quality of the soil it's in, and that does require others. So you need to have others shift their thinking as well and be committed and believe that this is actually better for everyone.
I mean, and then sure, it just gets me thinking about, you know, creating the right environment and things. But you mentioned that in your book again, you've referred to, you know, the Weight of Gold documentary and these kind of very high profile athletes who are, you know, under serious mental strain. And it was a bit of a revelation for me, because I'd heard about this documentary and I was keen to watch it, but you shared it with you encouraged me to I'm listening to the book, and B, okay, now I can watch this documentary. And I wanted to get through both of them before we spoke. It was like that other movie, and I can't remember the name off the top of my head now, but that movie where all the football players were banging their heads and getting the CTE. And there was the suicide rate amongst football players was off the charts, and they investigated to figure out what it was. In the same way, now Michael Phelps and the team that produced that have got this investigation with these Olympic athletes and the suicide rates. And it was emotionally, it was hard to watch for me, because I consider myself as someone who's passionate about high performance, and you know, I get starstruck speaking to people like you. It's a journey where you kind of get involved with this movie, and by the end, it's such a spoiler alert, there's such a dramatic end where one person on the journey is no longer there. You know, it was like mind blowing. I mean, okay, so all that to say, if a gold medalist is taking their life, what are the rest of us doing? Like, how can that be that the person that is achieving the success, and that really is the central part, well, I gather the second half of your book is all about, if the winners are taking their lives, then there's a problem. There's a problem across the board here. I see you nodding, and yeah, so I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. This is telling us that winning isn't working. It's not working for the winners, let alone everyone else discarded, feeling failures, feeling that, you know, they're excluded, there's no place for them. And the interesting thing was, I actually started off thinking about writing a book about the fact that I had got a silver medal at the Athens Olympics and what it's like to fail. Because actually they say in the research that silver medalists are the least happy on the podium because they're one step off what they wanted. I mean, actually the bronze medalists are often really happy because they're comparing themselves and thinking, I'm glad I didn't come fourth. But anyway, I started off thinking, what is this experience? You know, and I'd had all of these old fashioned mantras in my head that, you know, you're the first loser, you know, only winning counts. And, you know, I mean, I was, don't get me wrong, I was pretty happy having been to two Olympics and not getting on the podium. I kind of secretly thought, well, thank God there's a little bit of joy here. But I almost felt like I've got to show that I'm really unhappy I haven't won, though, because otherwise, you know, that's what this world is about.
That's the blueprint. Yeah.
And so I started kind of trying to make sense of, you know, the BBC commentator of my race, you know, says as we cross the line, you know, they're only in silver medal. I mean, you know, that's the judgment on my career. And I walked away thinking, I need to make peace with this. I need to make sense of this. And that was sort of what I was starting to think about. But as I was starting to dig into how do other people feel about coming second and this whole runner-up experience, that we're all runner-ups, we go for jobs or we try to get into schools or whatever it is. I then kept finding these gold medalists who also weren't happy. I thought, hang on a minute. No, you've won. I'm the one that's got the lifelong trauma because I've come second. But there was just, you uncovered all of these stories coming out all of the time now, across sports, not just the Olympics, across rugby, across cricket. You know, the mental health issues in that England cricket team that were fighting to, for the first time ever, to become the number one in the world for test cricket under Andrew Strauss. And they get the trophy, and there's men who are broken by the mental health issues that they've gone through. There's a brilliant documentary called The Edge all about it, that really kind of shows the other side of winning. And they sit with the trophy going, is that it? And I'm thinking, hang on a minute. I can't just write about silver medalists, because it's not, that's not working either. So, you know, that's really what then started me to kind of really put the lens out on the fact that we don't like to talk about this view of gold medalists. We're actually told, and I can remember coaches saying, don't have fun till you get on the top step of the podium, then life will be wonderful. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Because actually, how many people get to the top step? And there are lots of people who are broken by that, this sort of post-Olympic blues that you think suddenly, after you won a gold medal and stood on a podium for approximately 3 minutes, that the rest of your life is going to be fine. I mean, it just doesn't, it's just not common sense that that would be the case. And of course, there's this big crash when you realise that that's not the case and you've actually got all the flaws you had 2 hours ago before you went to race. And then, you know, you're almost in a worse position because this whole thing you've been building to isn't what you were led to believe. So we sell a myth. There's no need to sell that myth. You know, we've allowed winning to become disconnected from something that matters. So I want people to win, but I want them to win in a way that has meaning after the 3 minutes on the podium, that actually connects with what happens next and with what happens before. So they've had a good story and not cheated or been abused or got some ongoing mental health issue as a result of it. That moment on the podium needs to connect to the experience before and what you're going to do thereafter. So, you know, a bigger meaning to your journey, the purpose of it, the communities you connect with, and what you've learned that you're going to take into whatever comes next, whether it's another race or another part of your life.
Yeah, so many things there. We're not even going to get all to those. That last minute that you were talking, I can keep you busy for the next 3 days. Kath, I was very nervous to not put my foot in my mouth again like I did 20 minutes ago, but seeing as you brought it up, allow me, let's see how this lands. So you are a silver medalist. You seem bubbly and happy and engaged and alive and focused and enthusiastic to me. I mean, either you're putting on a very good front or that is largely what you like. Is it because it's 12 years later or is it because I could have spoken to you the next day? Or do you see the value in the silver medal and say, well, I'm the second best person at this Olympics out of a million other people in the world who couldn't even get here? I mean, please give me your thoughts on that, because you don't strike me as, I mean, I'm followed that same myth. The second place and the silver medalist are the people that take their lives and they're the most distraught and mental health issues. That's not what I'm seeing.
So actual fact, it's not the color of the medal. It's your own mindset. It's your expectations. It's your picture of success that determines these things. And I love that medal because it's actually taken me on this incredible journey of looking much deeper at so many different things, you know, in sport and beyond. And I think, you know, that what a medal is, a piece of metal. It's great. It's a lovely thing to have. Again, I'm not against trying to win them. But the stuff that I take from that journey every day, that I carry with me every day, is the experiences that I had, the stories I had, the relationships that I made, the way I responded to the challenges and the opportunities along the journey. That's the stuff that I carry. It's not the second I crossed the line. It's what happened over the 10 years that I was doing it. And the medal is a lovely part of that. But it by no means is all of it.
Yeah, that's a great way to sum it up. Did you get to that quickly? Did it take a day or two to get there? Did it happen kind of right away? Did it take you a 4-year journey to get to that thinking? I mean, were you this bubbly 3 weeks after?
So I really felt, I'd come 7th and 9th at the previous Olympics. So I secretly just felt, you know what? I did my best. I have something really precious. And I can get on with the rest of my life now. But, you know, it left me with a niggle of wanting to make sense of it and think, what does it mean? You know, what do I take from this? And I suppose to some extent, you know, there was a sort of 1 hour response that was a kind of, do you know, it wasn't the perfect outcome, but it was an outcome I can live with. And I haven't got any other outcome to live with, so I need to. And then I think there's now the sort of 17-year journey of how can I use that experience to inform what I do and the coaching work that I do and the leadership work that I do. And you know, it's allowed me to go on this incredible journey with the book, which in itself, you know, was a sort of Olympiad of writing, you know, to get through and to probe this from other people's perspectives and learn so much. And that is incredible. That's, you know, probably these last 4 years of doing that has been, you know, the most incredible period.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. You know, I can see that we're coming to the last bit of the interview, and I've got so much I still want to ask. So I'm going to pencil you in for a second interview because we need to get there. So the bit that you've talked about now is where I did want to get to, is this sort of reinventing yourself. So you had a break. So you took a break from your international rowing career and you went to something completely different, the Foreign Office. I mean, casually, you went to a couple of war zones and figured that out. You know, not too dissimilar high-performance teams, and because of the milliseconds and the grams and the stroke corrections, a high-performance team because of the high-risk environment. You know, there are some similarities you can draw there. I do want to know about specifically being in war zones, but as it relates to taking the break and then getting the love of the sport back a year later and getting back into it, do you think that helped you in your journey to go from, you know, where we're saying that we're celebrating the silver medal and not being depressed by it? Do you think that the break helped you because you could now, you mentioned reframing it and what does it mean to me? Was the break part of that journey and the reinventing yourself as a Foreign Office correspondent, and now I'm an Olympic athlete again, and whoa, this is amazing. I'm doing two things now. I was doing one before.
It was a massive part of it because it gave me perspective, and it gave me an absolutely huge scale of perspective in which to put the activity of trying to make a boat go backwards as fast as possible over 2,000 meters on water.
I love that.
You know,
I love
within
that.
The world of, within the world, the wider perspective of world politics. So it was a fantastic perspective check that there was, you know, there's probably a few other things that are more important than that. And that was just a breath of fresh air to my thinking. Yes, it absolutely gave me a confidence that I could operate in a different world. And, you know, when I came back, I determined that I would try and have a different experience. And I can remember the sports psychologist then saying to me, what are you going to gain if you come back if you don't win a medal? And I thought initially, oh my God, you know, we can't talk about that. That's terrible. A winner wouldn't talk about that, would they? And he said, no, come on, bear with me, because if you look at the pure stats, it's not great on anyone winning a medal, because you've got 11,000 athletes, only 300 are going to win. And, you know, you've got all sorts of uncontrollable factors, you know, injuries, weather, environment, umpires, referees, you name it. You also haven't got a great track record either. So, you know, this is just not good odds if you look at it from a kind of pure statistical point of view. But anyway, bear with me. What are the things you want to gain? And I did want to have a different experience, so I went with it. And it was just a brilliant question, because all of those things I wanted to get out of this, I wanted to have a different experience, really think about working in a team in a different way, be part of creating a different culture, you know, looking after myself, recovering, you know, thinking about the resilience that I'm going to build and things that I will be able to take to that Foreign Office job that was then waiting to go back to. And of course, by focusing in on all of those things, what did it do? It helped me to go faster. So it was a brilliant question, and it set me up, you know, to get a better result. And that's the paradox for me of performance, that actually it's by letting go of results that we optimize the results. But we often can't see that because we get sucked into what we're told all the time from the media commentators, where we're just looking at who's one and second and third, and we're just looking at outcomes. There's an obsession always. We see through the lens. Everything was great if we won. You know, one penalty kick different, and the manager was brilliant if his team had won, but he's got it all wrong if they haven't. When clearly, you know, one penalty kick he shouldn't determine everything he does on that. It makes no sense. And so we look always through this outcome lens, and we have to stop doing that, because life goes on beyond each outcome and there are so many bigger factors involved. So it gave me that sort of really different lens within which to say, let's see if we can make this a different journey, and let's still see how fast we can go.
Yeah, in my own life, I mean, I can remember this section in the book so clearly, you know, because it was just resonating and resonating and resonating for, you know, for pages and pages. I was enjoying this conversation that, if you'd asked me 10, 15 years ago, you know, listening to people on the press, because as you mentioned, there was a change in the popular press, or actually in the athletes' mindset, and how they shared a message to the world, and the press didn't quite get it, that we're focusing on the process, the results will take care of themselves, I'm focusing on the process, and you made that very clear in the book, and it's a great message. And if you asked me about my thinking, what I read about interviews at the time, or watched people on TV in Formula One, I would have said, yeah, like, I'm not worried about the points, I'm not worried about the championship, I thought, well, you're a bit full of yourself. I know you're trying to be kind of casual and make it look like you're not so ego-driven. I know what you really mean. I don't believe that anymore. Today, I believe them when they say this is a process. having been on this journey myself for the last couple of years, and you know, being out there and trying to be a creator, create things, obviously I want something that I create to be valuable and meaningful. And if it resonates with 1,000 people, that's great. But if it resonates with 100,000 people, that's even greater. But I'm not writing or creating or building or sharing for 100,000 people. I'm doing it for the process, and the results follow, you know, and some days they're good and some days they're not good, but carry on with the process, stick to the process, and I believe it. And you summed it up so nicely. I really, really enjoyed your book. It was great. And I'm loving this conversation too.
Great. Thank you very much. It's that challenge of getting out of finite games, if you like. It's another kind of sort of framework you can put on it, that each result is finite, whether you win a race or not. It's a snapshot, a moment in time. You could do the same thing the next day, get a different result. It's just a snapshot. But we go on in between. The sort of infinite piece, if you like, whilst we're alive, is our journey, our learning. And our learning doesn't stop when we finish a race. And our learning, you know, just carries on. And that's the essence of the long win, is to focus on what has lasting value. We get information from these sort of little milestones along the way, but they in themselves don't hold the meaning. It's what carries on underneath them. And if we take that away, then we're left with something that's very empty or shallow, regardless of the result.
Yeah. So then if we try and let's pretend we had a magic wand and we're going to fix the system as it relates to athletes, because we can't do it for everything, but let's say athletes, someone who's, 5 years, 7 years professional and, you know, did fairly well, but now they're in this mental health issue like Michael Phelps was sharing in his documentary. What's the answer? Do we take them out of the game for 18 months and put them in the Foreign Office in Iraq for a year and come back with perspective and come back and win? Well, I mean, quite literally, we could do something like that. Say, just get out of the environment for a year and get perspective. Come back invigorated.
Yeah, I think we have often over-professionalized sports and not allowed people to have an identity outside it. So there's great research around the need to have multiple identities, if you like. You know, not to think that my value is purely on how fast I make a rowing boat go. My value stays the same, irrespective of how fast my boat goes. It's great. I want it to go faster, of course, but that doesn't define who I am. So we've got to separate out these things. And I am other things other than a rower. And yet we've actually often, coaches have been sort of, you know, well-intentioned, but almost stopped you having distractions. We don't want you to focus on anything else. We'll make your life easy. You don't have to do anything else. And actually that's detracted from performance and created some of these mental health issues. So I think the first thing is to think about the environment and whether an athlete is thriving as a person, not just an athlete. And then to think about, you know, again, the sort of the longevity and whether you might have a longer career if you have a year out at some point. And we often push to come back earlier from injuries and things because of the next race. But actually, we're really sacrificing, you know, 100 races in 3 years' time because we're never going to get there. And so, you know, we need to have that kind of sense of, you know, really athlete driven. What's right for you? And we, you know, we all have different development curves and, you know, speeds and plateaus of how fast we improve. So, you know, again, trying to fit athletes into, fix them into a kind of fixed way of being as if we're robots, actually limits us, because then you're not using all of the potential that an athlete could have.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I mean, so you seem to, we've discussed a couple of broad themes here, and it's great, but if you were just an Olympic athlete, you know, you would have the stage open to you and you could go on a speaking tour and a book tour and a management tour and a leadership tour, you know, for 10 years. But you've really cracked open something at a very good time too, when other Olympic athletes, Phelps, etc., are talking about the same message and mental health issues. But then you can also get into the weeds of teamwork and, you know, high performance teams, as we discussed, of the specifics of rowing and the power curve and eight in a boat and timing, etc. Which area of these kind of three opportunities have you gone down? Because, I mean, seemingly you could do all three and you could combine the three. But so what are you busy with now besides the book as it relates to training and coaching and sharing the message? What do you do on a day-to-day basis and how can people get involved with you?
Yeah, so I do a combination of work largely within the leadership development space, which can cover different sectors of business as well as sport, politics, education as well, and work with leaders and teams to have a broader, more holistic view. So that's sometimes coaching, that's sometimes workshops or sort of small program of working with teams or with individuals to rethink how they are setting themselves up and to make sure that the goals aren't short term, that the metrics aren't sort of leaving things out, that they are understanding the cultural piece as well as the kind of individual development piece. So it's a range of work, speaking, facilitating, teaching on business school courses, and, you know, a little bit of activism to try and get more change within the sports sector and the high performance sport as to how we are kind of setting up the future for athletes.
So what is it? Is the activism that wakes you up in the morning to get going? Is it sharing the message of what teamwork, when it's successful, can feel like? We talked about that sensation of knowing that we're in sync and that I can sense that this is the right time to add a bit more or slack. What is the bit that fires you up each day?
Oh, that's a good question. I like the variety of almost coming at it from different prongs so that I understand what's happening on the ground and support individuals. But actually also I'm trying to think about in the bigger picture, how might we get some change? So, you know, I probably should think more about which is going to have most impact, but I get something from both of those. And you know, I hope there's a ripple effect from both of those. I think often change comes both top down and bottom up. And it is all about really shifting people's thinking. It's actually challenging those assumptions. There's no sort of quick formula. There are themes we can explore much more around the way that we learn, the purpose that we've developed for ourselves, the kind of way the relationships we have. There are lots of themes that I help people to sort of rebalance their perspective with. But fundamentally, it's about challenging your mindset and thinking, are some of these myths that you've taken on, are they really helping you or are they holding you back?
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, it's been fascinating and stimulating and a real treat for this conversation, Kath. I really appreciate your time. Can people reach out to you directly or what's the best way for people to get hold of you if they like what they've heard and want to know more?
Absolutely. So I have a website, kathbishop.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter at the Kath Bishop. I'm on Instagram, Kath_Bishop. So yeah, find me and let's continue the conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Kath, and all the best with the activism and all the exciting things ahead.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I'm excited to have you on this journey with us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and remember to subscribe to the show to catch weekly episodes so that you can build your high performance team.
This episode was proudly brought to you by Salesforce. Are you open to reskilling yourself? Are you interested in current opportunities? Salesforce is providing a free 10-week online training program teaching you the fundamentals of Salesforce. Salesforce qualifications are in big demand right now, in South Africa and all over the world. At the end of this 10-week training course, you will be eligible for these jobs in the Salesforce ecosystem. So click on the link in the show notes, sign up today, and reskill yourself for the future.